This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 14, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. American troops have surrounded Najaf and are threatening to invade it. South Koreans go to the polls today after the recent impeachment of their president. And President Bush met with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon today at the White House. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. South Africa's polling stations have closed for the day, and the Independent Electoral Commission says there was a high voter turnout for the country's third democratic elections. Naeem Jenna reports from Johannesburg.
Before opening at 7 a.m., long queues had already formed at some of the 17,000 voting stations. Not many surprises are expected. The ruling African National Congress will again win the national election with Thabo Mbeki as president. The only question is whether it will again get a two-thirds majority. The ANC will also win seven provinces. The only competition will be in two provinces where the ANC has been part of coalition governments, with the Inkatha Freedom Party in KwaZulu-Natal and with the former Apartheid National Party in the Western Cape. No big surprise either about the national official opposition. The business-oriented Democratic Alliance has been and will remain so, while smaller parties continue raising their voices. Effective power in parliament will thus remain right of center. Many leftist social movements had called for protest votes. The Landless People's Movement called for a boycott unless the government solved the land question, and the Anti-Privatization Forum for a spoilt ballot to protest government's neoliberal policies. Today's festive atmosphere is over, and South Africans will wait till Monday for the final results. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Naeem Jenna in Johannesburg.
Vice President Dick Cheney's stop in China today focused primarily on Taiwan. Free Speech Radio News' Severine Bardon reports from Beijing.
Dick Cheney restated the U.S. commitment to the One China principle and its opposition to any unilateral step by either side. But he did not fully meet China's expectations that hoped for an abandonment of the Taiwan Relations Act. This law, passed by the American Congress 25 years ago, is the main cause of tension between Beijing and Washington, since it requires the U.S. to defend Taiwan if it is attacked and leaves room for American arms sales to the island. China has recently been so infuriated by American plans to sell advanced radar system to Taiwan that former president and current chief of armies Jiang Zemin suggested in his meeting with Cheney today that Sino-American relations could see their future hinged in the Taiwan issue. Dick Cheney's stance didn't come at the only disappointment today for China, which is currently courting Western countries to get support on the Taiwan issue. Romano Prodi, the president of the European Union's Commission, also visiting China today, declared it improbable that the EU would remove its 15-year-old arms embargo on China due to its poor human rights record. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Severine Bardon in Beijing.
The Caribbean nations want the United Nations to investigate the overthrow of the elected Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, but the U.S. and France are blocking the move. Heider Rizvi reports from the United Nations.
Diplomats and UN sources say the U.S. and France do not want any kind of probe by the Security Council into Aristide's ouster. Both countries have warned that any attempt by the Council to adopt a resolution would be vetoed. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says he's unable to do anything unless he receives a formal request from the members of the Council or the 15-member Caribbean community, which is also known as CARICOM. But CARICOM diplomats say they are under tremendous pressure not to follow up on their request. However, a source close to Kofi Annan told SSRN that there is a fair chance of hearing on Haiti by the UN General Assembly, whose decisions have no binding effect on the member states. Aristide, who is now living in exile in Jamaica, has said repeatedly that he did not resign willingly and that he was kidnapped by the U.S. forces from his presidential palace. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
Yesterday marked the two-year anniversary of Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez's defeat of a right-wing coup attempt. Greg Wilpert is in Caracas.
President Chavez celebrated the anniversary with a major demonstration of his supporters in front of the presidential palace, where he repeated charges that the U.S. government was behind the coup attempt 2 years ago. This week in Venezuela is perhaps one of the most important weeks since that coup attempt, because the opposition and the Elections Council are expected to conclude their negotiations about the modalities under which citizens can recertify their signatures in the petition for a recall referendum against President Chavez. If an agreement is reached, which is considered likely, petition signers can confirm their signatures, and if at least 600,000 do so, a presidential recall referendum will be scheduled for early August of this year. It is possible, though, that the opposition, just as during the coup attempt 2 years ago, underestimates the president's popular support and would lose once again.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
Pressure is mounting on the United States and Britain over the Fallujah onslaught. Today, Human Rights Watch announced it's launching an investigation into the accusations of excessive force and civilian deaths in the Iraqi city. Meanwhile, today, the Philippines says it's considering pulling out its 100 troops from Iraq, while Russia plans to dispatch airplanes to evacuate over 800 of its nationals. This is Iraq's Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani has warned the occupation forces not to assault the holy cities of Karbala and Najaf. In a statement, Sistani said the religious authority should use its weapon to defend Iraqi rights in the case the occupation forces entered the two cities. American troops have surrounded Najaf, which holds the shrine of the revered Imam Ali, and are threatening to invade it. From Baghdad, FSRN correspondent Aaron Glantz reports.
This is what happened the last time foreign troops fought Muqtada al-Sadr's Mehdi army on the streets of Najaf. Hundreds of al-Sadr's followers had gathered in front of a military base for Spanish and Salvadoran forces, demanding the release of one of the cleric's top lieutenants. By the end of the day, dozens of Iraqis were dead. Two Salvadoran soldiers also lost their lives. Now, the U.S. Army has surrounded Najaf, one of the holiest cities in Shiite Islam. An invasion seems likely, if one is to believe the statements made by President Bush, that Muqtada al-Sadr must be captured or killed.
In the south of Iraq, coalition forces face riots and attacks that are being incited by a radical cleric named al-Sadr. He has assembled some of his supporters into an illegal militia and publicly supported the terrorist groups Hamas and Hezbollah. Al-Sadr's methods of violence and intimidation are widely repudiated by other Iraqi Shia.
President Bush's rhetoric ignores the power of the name al-Sadr. The Sadr family has a long history of resisting occupation. Muqtada al-Sadr's great-grandfather fought against British imperialism in Iraq. His father and grandfather were both executed by Saddam Hussein. Businessman Radha Abu Jaber al-Saadi doesn't follow Muqtada, but he has great admiration for the Sadr family. He explains why Sadr's grandfather, Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Sadr, was executed in 1979.
Saddam wanted him to declare the Ba'ath Party blessed and the Islamic Preaching Party to be declared a sin. He also said Saddam was not a Muslim, neither Sunni nor Shia, so al-Sadr was killed.
An entire neighborhood of Baghdad is named after Muqtada al-Sadr's father, Ayatollah Mohammed Sadiq al-Sadr. He was executed by Saddam's regime in 1999 after he organized mass gatherings for Friday prayer and Islamic court separate from Saddam's legal system. His killing set off a revolt against the dictator, which was not backed by the United States.
From the first moment the spark began from al-Sadr City, then it was called Saddam City. And it just became bigger and bigger when they killed Mohammed Sadiq al-Sadr. It went to Najaf, Nasiriyah, and Kut, and they even toppled the Saddam regime for a few hours in Basra before the regime came and crushed it.
Today, Muqtada al-Sadr draws his followers primarily from poor, disaffected portions of Iraq's Shiite population. But Sadr's followers are many. This sound was recorded by Sadr's organization on April 10, 2003, a year ago, only a day after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Hundreds of members of Sadr's Mehdi army cover their faces with black hoods, marching in lockstep, pledging loyalty to their leader. Shanam Abu Jaber is a Sunni businessman living in Baghdad.
These people, everyone disrespects them because they are poorly educated and some of them are members of gangs. But the Sadr family is well respected in Iraq, and even Muqtada, because his father and a lot of his family were killed by the ex-regime. So when these people find someone who gives them a gun and recognizes them as human, they will support him.
But despite his disparaging statements about al-Sadr's followers, Shanam Abu Jaber nonetheless opposes a U.S. military assault on Najaf.
The Americans made a big mistake by giving this issue to the military. These things you have to give to a political man. For the army, they can just understand one thing, kill or not kill. These kinds of statements about killing Sadr make people angry. The Arab people's passion will make them move, so when they listen to such statements that we will kill, they will have passion for al-Sadr, even if they don't like him.
With sound from James Longley, I'm Aaron Glantz for Free Speech Radio News in Baghdad, Iraq.
The September 11 Commission finished its 2 days of public hearings this week by hearing from CIA Director George Tenet and FBI Director Robert Mueller. Both of them, along with most witnesses this past month, have praised the Patriot Act for breaking down walls of communication between surveillance agencies and for easing surveillance restrictions in order to stop a potential terrorist act. However, civil liberties groups are not as convinced. Our DC editor Mitch Jeserich reports.
According to a 9/11 Commission report, officials in the Clinton and Bush administrations revealed that both were uncertain about how to regard the al-Qaeda threat before September 11, 2001. During a press conference on Tuesday night, President Bush forcefully put the blame of 9/11 on Osama bin Laden. However, he wasn't as forceful when asked why he couldn't answer questions to the 9/11 Commission without Vice President Dick Cheney at his side.
The 9/11 Commission wants to ask us questions. That's why we're meeting, and I look forward to meeting with them and answering their questions.
Why you're appearing together rather than separately, which was their request?
Because it's a good chance for both of us to answer questions that the 9/11 Commission is looking forward to asking us, and I'm looking forward to answering them. Let's see. Hold on for a minute. Let's see. Oh.
The 9/11 Commission heard testimony on Wednesday from CIA Director George Tenet and FBI Director Robert Mueller. Tenet said it will take 5 years to have the kind of clandestine service the country needs to avert terrorist attacks. Tenet told the commission before 9/11, legal restrictions kept intelligence agencies from sharing information. Tenet and almost everyone who testified to the 9/11 Commission in the past month have praised the Patriot Act, including commissioners themselves, for reducing such restrictions. In particular, the Patriot Act weakened the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, also known as FISA, that was meant to erect a wall between criminal and intelligence investigations and address abuses of FBI spying on U.S. citizens. On Wednesday, FBI Director Robert Mueller testified in front of the commission.
And what you have now is integrated in one agency within the United States, the ability, looking at it with state and local law enforcement, to push the intelligence aspects of any set of facts, so long as you can gather more intelligence, identify more persons, identify more telephone numbers, identify more email addresses, identify the networks both here in the United States. But then when you have to neutralize that individual in the sense of taking action, we have the ability to take that action at the appropriate time, and the decision maker has all those facts in front of them.
The debate of the Patriot Act may heat up once again this summer as President Bush is calling for the reauthorization of certain provisions in the act set to expire in a year and a half, which includes investigating library records, the sharing of wiretaps between intelligence agencies, and internet surveillance without a warrant. In Idaho, opening arguments of the first case concerning an individual and the Patriot Act began on Wednesday. Graduate student Sami Omar Ahusayan is facing counts of running websites for groups that the State Department has characterized as terrorist organizations, such as Hamas. The Patriot Act makes it illegal to give technical advice to such groups. A federal judge in California has already ruled that the provision threatens both the First and Fifth Amendment rights, and Rand Lewis, an international affairs professor at Idaho University, is following the case closely.
If you look at Hamas and you look at Hezbollah and other organizations in the Middle East, yes, they have a history of terrorist acts against Israel. However, on the other hand, they have a great history for humanitarian support, particularly for the Palestinian peoples that have been displaced. And so You have kind of a double-edged sword that's involved here, and it's how the prosecution can link the dots that he knew specifically that that money and that effort in the website was going towards terrorism, or in fact was it going towards the humanitarian side of these organizations.
The 9/11 Commission's final report is due this summer. It's still to be seen how it will influence the debate over the Patriot Act. I'm Mitch Jezrich for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush met with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon today at the White House, where he said that Israel has a claim on some West Bank land the Palestinians say is theirs, while also negating any right of return for Palestinian refugees. Today's meeting is seen as a shift in policy that could have major implications for Middle East peace negotiations and Palestinian rights. We begin with Ariel Sharon speaking at the joint White House news conference and then get reaction from Nadia Hijab, Executive Director of the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C.
My plan will create a new and better reality for the state of Israel. And it also has the potential to create the right conditions to resume negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians.
So, Nadia, if you could explain to us, what is this plan that Prime Minister Sharon is talking about?
Well, it's his plan for unilateral withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, and in exchange for which he, and for settlements from the West Bank, in exchange for which he's basically got the United States to sign off on the rest of his plan, which is basically to impose the kind of settlement that he sees as the outcome of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He will swallow up large chunks of the West Bank, which have been settled by Israel. He's got no objection to the wall that Israel has been constructing through the West Bank. All that President Bush has said is that Israel should see that wall as a security wall that does not prejudge the final border, but not that Israel should not be building it. And meanwhile, Gaza will remain encircled, with the Gazans able to come in and out based on, you know, at Israel's whim.
It seems like he actually also negated, President Bush did in one of his comments, negated the right of return for Palestinian refugees. How serious is this?
Well, it's very serious in that the United States, which is a member of the Security Council of the United Nations and is supposed to be upholding international law, is basically saying to him, okay, you don't have to pay any attention to international law, which requires that refugees have a right to return. And these are also UN resolutions that Israel has itself signed off on, Resolution 194, which provides for the right of the refugees to return to the part of Palestine that became Israel. So what President Bush has said is accepted basically Sharon's argument that Palestinians can go back to this truncated Palestinian state he hopes to establish and would never go back to Israel. So he's made a lot of fuss about his withdrawal from Gaza, which is something that he's never really wanted anyway. You know, Gaza is one of the most overcrowded places on earth, and basically taken East Jerusalem and large chunks of the West Bank and will be able to turn any Palestinian state into a very truncated and split up through Israeli roads, controlled and under Israeli control, but the borders under Israeli control. So, you know, we're foreseeing a disastrous situation that is not going to lead to peace between Israelis and Palestinians anytime soon.
Now, Ariel Sharon has also ceded some of the settlements, saying Israel will give them up. How do Palestinians see this? Is this a step forward, a step towards peace?
Well, the Palestinians look at all the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza as illegal, and they are, in fact, illegal under international law. I think the real problem here is that the Palestinians are being required to negotiate with Israel, and you know, there are people living under occupation, so they're negotiating under duress. And this has been going on for about a decade now, that the Palestinians are being required to negotiate an outcome. And here we see what the result is. You cannot negotiate with one of the strongest military powers in the world that's controlling you and your land and your borders and expect to reach any kind of situation. So I think the answer is for the Palestinians now to call for full Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories without any preconditions, and then to negotiate all the outstanding issues later, after the withdrawal.
Nadia Hijab is the Executive Director of the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much.
Today, South Koreans take to the polls after the opposition-controlled parliament impeached President No Moo-hyun on charges of election fraud. North Korea has been the most outspoken about South Korean politics since the impeachment of President No last month. According to reports, the North Korean state media has urged South Koreans to vote against the Conservative Party, as a change could have significant impact on Pyongyang's aid. But since the impeachment, President No's popularity has risen among South Koreans, with massive street protests against the impeachment bill throughout the country. Some South Koreans and Korean Americans say anti-impeachment is not pro-President No, but support for the Democratic Labour Party. Mae Kim reports.
Today is election day for South Koreans for all 299 seats in the legislature, now controlled by the conservative Grand National Party. To supporters of President No Moo-hyun, his impeachment was a conservative coup against democracy. On Friday, March 12, 2004, South Korea's National Assembly voted to strip President No of his constitutional powers for up to 6 months, while a 9-member constitutional court determines whether to uphold his impeachment. John Pfeffer, author of North Korea, South Korea, explains the situation.
Essentially, he made one sentence intervening in the campaign, saying that he would work hard in support of his own party. And it's pretty clear that you're not supposed to do that as the president.
But ironically, his impeachment has created negative responses among South Koreans towards the opposition parties that impeached the president. People like Lee Chang-gun, international director of the Korean Federation of Trade Unions, calls the impeachment illegal.
President No Moo-hyun impeached by the conservative members of parliament, including Korean Grand National Party and Democratic Party in Korea. All of them are very, very far right-wing. That's why the majority of Korean ordinary people oppose the impeachment of President No, because ordinary people think that the President No Moo-hyun was elected democratically, whether they like Mr. No's policy or not.
Some people even cautiously predict the impeachment might lead South Koreans to vote for the present party in the general elections. John Lee is professor of sociology at the University of California.
My suspicion, which is shared by many observers, is that this will propel President No's party, Uri Party, into a majority of the legislature.
But Lee Chang-gun of KCTU says he will not support President No's party in the general elections.
We think the whole conservative forces, including No Moo-hyun's party, don't represent the real interest of workers and real interest of Korean ordinary people.
South Koreans are not the only people who are concerned about the impeachment and the general elections. Many Korean Americans in America spend hours on the internet every day trying to find out the political situation in South Korea. Joo Kim is with an organization called Young Koreans United.
After the impeachment, like, everybody was actually talking about it. I'm more like with the first generation Koreans, and then first generation Koreans were really, really concerned about it. And they were talking about it everywhere, like including churches, families, and everywhere.
He says he's very concerned about a possibility of South Korean Constitutional Court accepting the impeachment. But he thinks the general elections might bring a positive aspect to South Korean politics.
Actually, one thing I am really excited is that this Congress election will be the first election that the Progressive Party, which is Democratic Labor Party for now, will have a seat on Congress.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Mia Kim.
Faith, South Dakota, a rural community that borders the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation, has been the center of racial complaints over the last 2 months. Allegations of racism in the Faith school system first hit the local media in February. Within weeks, the death of a Lakota teenager in the school's playground added fuel to an already simmering fire of racial unrest. FSRN correspondent Jim Kent visited Faith, a little town where people are reluctant to talk.
Blink while you're driving along Highway 212, and you just might miss the town of Faith. Billed as the Prairie Oasis, the cowboy community's main industries are ranching and farming. Faith has a drugstore, a hardware store, a grocery store, a bank, and one K-12 school, with a student population of 200. Cheyenne River Sioux tribal member Callie Johnson says one of the reasons she moved to Faith was so her children wouldn't have to be bused to school. But Johnson says it didn't take long for her son to start coming home with problems as part of a handful of American Indian students in the mostly non-Indian Faith school system.
And to have his front permanent teeth repaired because the kid smashed his face off the sidewalk at the school. We've had him to the emergency room, accidentally knocked down and accidentally kicked so hard it bruised and swelled his kidney up. Accidentally knocked down and accidentally kicked in the head 3 times.
The situation became worse last fall, Johnson alleges, when Faith School principal Mel Dutton picked up her 12-year-old son and shook him because he was moving too slowly. Johnson also claims that except for a third-grade teacher, the school has ignored the fact that her son is dyslexic and blames his poor school performance on being stupid. In February, Johnson formally reported the incidents to the national advocacy group Students and Teachers Against Racism, a number of state legislators, and the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. South Dakota's Education Secretary Rick Melmer says his office is aware of the situation and is hoping it will be taken care of at the local level. According to Callie Johnson, the problems of racism in the Faith School District remain.
It's really hard to deal with when they attack your kids, and you as a parent sit there and listen to them come in after school, and they're crying, and they're begging you to homeschool them. They're crying because they don't understand how come the people are so mean.
In the midst of Callie Johnson's allegations, Faith School's image went from bad to worse. On the morning of March 5th, the body of 17-year-old Christopher Long Elk, a former student of the school, was found hanging by the neck from a swing set on the Faith School grounds. Long Elk's body was left where it was until law enforcement personnel arrived on the scene. American Civil Liberties Union of the Dakotas director Jennifer Ring notes that American Indian community residents have objected to the school's failure to cancel classes that day in order to protect students from seeing the young Lakota man's remains.
What happened with the other children? Was that handled appropriately? They should have at least been trying to contact parents and say, if you want to come get your children.
Ring adds the professional counseling should also have been available to the students. Faith School Superintendent Terry Mayer would not offer comments on the issues surrounding Long Elk's death or any of Johnson's allegations and referred all questions to the school's attorney, who was unavailable for comment. Jennifer Ring wouldn't speculate on Callie Johnson's complaints, but says she understands the suspicions that have arisen regarding Long Elk's suicide, given the history of investigations into Indian deaths in South Dakota.
And the fact that so many of them have been ruled suicide, accidental, harmless, when most reasonable people would think that the death did not look particularly harmless. I'm not sure whether it will ever be completely resolved, but I think that the overlying question about how deaths in Indian country are treated is a significant one for law enforcement and the justice system to address.
As for Callie Johnson, since her allegations about racism in the Faith School, she's received virus-infected emails and dead birds on her doorstep. But Johnson says she won't be run out of town or out of the Faith School, where, according to its website, students are taught the worthwhile values of honesty, responsibility, and respect. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent in Faith, South Dakota.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.